This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz.
Today's program is a panel discussion of what are being called disruptive technologies. Ride-sharing services like Uber and Lyft are companies like Lime Bike, the company that brought hundreds of scooters to Honolulu streets only to have them confiscated by the city, say they offer better, faster, cheaper alternatives. Today, we're asking if these companies are bringing about a change in business ethics, and we're asking our listeners to join in that discussion.
And joining us in our studio today are Vasilis Sirmos, the University of Hawaii Vice President for Research and Innovation, and Jim Dater, Professor Emeritus of the UH Center for Future Studies.
Welcome to you both, and our listeners can join in that discussion by calling us at these one of these numbers, 941-3689 or 1-877-941-3689 if you're on the neighbor islands. And, you know, we've been hearing a lot about these so-called disruptive technologies, and in talking about that, Catherine and I have both sort of asked ourselves and asked others, is this a shift in the way people are doing business in terms of their ethical stance?
Well, first of all, I think that all technology is disruptive. What's new now is the speed with which new technologies develop. Mm-hmm. So as far as the ethical question is concerned, our ethics is based upon governing the things we can do. And what new technology does is bring in abilities to do things that we couldn't do before and therefore don't have easy ethical answers towards. Mm-hmm. And so we fall back on the ethics based on old technologies when the new ones comes along. And then if you have multiple technologies bombarding us, at a certain point we sort of give up and say either we're going to be opposed to it or just let it be. I'm going to try to withdraw from it.
Is that what has happened today?
I think that it's something like that, and that a lot of the people that are politically unsatisfied, economically unsatisfied at the present time are, if you will, suffering from the consequences of this rapid technological and hence ethical, religious, moral, if you will, change.
Well, that change outpaces regulation, right?
Yes, and actually, as Jim said, it is about the speed of technology, and the technology itself is not the problem, I believe. What has been happening the last 10, 20 years is that technology has been touching other areas of our everyday life where some of these problems rise. If you look at the past performance or past technologies or current technologies, for example, in the life science, in cancer, in medicine, they're very well regulated. Actually, people will tell you they're over-regulated, mm-hmm. and therefore that impedes progress. However, if you see different technologies like Facebook, social media, they have started entering our life in a very different way, and regulating common sense is sometimes an impossible task.
We're seeing this on the online booking platforms with, you know, Airbnb, VRBO, and it's just causing lots of chaos in what used to be an orderly, model, business model. And regulators kind of saw this coming because they're watching all this disruption across the world, really, in all these different cities where these various new companies spring up.
You're absolutely correct, and some of those technologies are impacting ourselves personally very meaningfully, and I'm going to give you an example. People talk about Facebook and secure data, your personal information, but can you imagine some of these technologies are touching our health records? Most of our health records right now, they are online. And it is a much easier to steal your personality and your credit cards. But can you imagine if someone steals your medical history? You'll never be able to recover from that. So this type of technologies are very dangerous, and trying to regulate them is a good thing. So it is starting now. You see a lot of regulation coming out of the European Union. I don't know where the U.S. is going to go with respect to that. Congress is actually threatening that they're going to actually take some action. We don't know where they're going to go with this.
What has the European Union done?
The European Union now, with respect to the social media, they require transparency. If Facebook has any advertisement, they require to disclose where the advertisement comes from, whether your data is being used, how it is being used, provide a report to the user, which some of those are onerous requirements. However, they are, I want to say, good requirements, because some of that data is being used by companies and people that you don't want to have your name in there or your personal information. It's not only yourself and your information with respect to your credit cards, but also how you live your life.
Right, what you choose to like on Facebook or whatever.
So this is your own life, right? It's more than a credit card number. So it is very dangerous in that sense, and you can opt out to that.
And that's why we're seeing a lot of these companies saying, hey, we've changed our policy, and all of a sudden it's like in the past, I think, week or two, it's like, whoo, what's all this?
Actually, that was triggered because of the European Union regulation, and now everybody gets this information.
These changes, specifically the ones that we've been talking about, are hitting at privacy primarily and sense of identity. And yet, from my point of view, as a futurist, I don't always look ahead. I look back as well. Privacy itself is a rather recent concept. The notion that you had an identity or you had secrets about yourself that everyone else didn't know was certainly not true in hunting-gathering societies. It was not true in agricultural societies. It wasn't even true in most industrial societies, where most of us still lived in small towns. Mm-hmm. And everyone knew our name and knew everything about it. In fact, many foreign languages, non-Western languages, don't have a term for privacy and borrow the English word or some other to get this new concept. But it has become very important in recent years. And yet I see many people, many young people especially, eagerly taking photographs of themselves, right, doing things and putting them online. And it's a question of whether that knowledge can be used against you somehow. That's really seems to be the crux of it. Otherwise, people are quite happy to have everybody know who they are.
When you say you look backwards, I mean, I think back to the Downton Abbey, you know, butler staring at the toaster, and they were dealing with, the change from horse-drawn carriages to cars and electricity. it's that upheaval and the, oh, my goodness, do I want to go there? Do I want to learn how to use this toaster?
Yeah. Right, yes, that's right. And yet I think most of us feel, at least let me put it this way. I went to Japan as a fresh PhD and in order to teach at a Japanese university, and they wanted to give me a maid to come in the house. But I couldn't stand having her around. I mean, she was really a snoop, right? She knew everything and infantilized me and my wife and our family by doing things that I could do perfectly well myself. But again, that's not the way the folks in the Abbey felt. They were quite happy to have someone else do things for them and had difficulty adjusting to it.
I like your point that all technology is disruptive, and you know we no longer burn whale oil to light our homes, right? And that was an abrupt switch, and no one wants that to come back, right? And the arguments in favor of ride sharing services are, hey, come on, you know, you're getting the same thing cheaper, faster, better. What's to complain about? But,
well, you know, one of the things I'd like to comment about is that the pace with which technology changed and the pace with which some technologies change faster than others. I think that's what Vaclav was saying earlier as well. The example I always use is that for thousands of years, communication and transportation technologies went step by step, if you will, together. Mm-hmm. And what the world we live in now is a consequence of incredible changes in communication technology from the 1970s. And there really has been no technological breakthrough. There have been software breakthroughs, transportation since then. The 747, SCS, things like this, there's been no improvement. A drone is certainly a very disruptive new technology, but in the scheme of things, it's not flying by a different mechanism and so forth. Mm-hmm. So also with Uber and Lyft, it's a software orgware change in a well-known technology.
Explain orgware to me.
Well, from my point of view, and I'm not alone, but on the other hand, this is not necessarily the way everyone looks at it. There is hardware, which is the physical thing. There is software, which is instructions for using the physical thing. And there is orgware, that is people who either teach or do or create the hardware and the software. And these are the people who are usually impacted when a new technology comes along, and they no longer are needed as a new technology requires new orgware, organization.
So we're seeing that in some hotels now. Robotics, automation, they're replacing people. I think the concierge service in some hotels, laundry services, and I know the unions are a little wary because they're protective of their members. Yeah. They want their members to keep their jobs.
But, you know, we have to look at that also. If we remember 15, 20 years ago when we walked in at the airport to check in, there were all these airline employees checking in our baggage, taking our tickets. If you go right now in any airport, you're pretty much going to see nobody. You have a counter. You put your card in there, and you check in yourself, and you bypass all that work. And if you want to call that counter a robot or a substitute, that's what it is. So I see you bring up a different issue. What are you going to do with the workforce development of all these people? How are you going to retrain them to do different type of jobs in order to be actually successful within our society? So that to me is a much bigger issue rather than losing job A or job B, but try to retrain a whole set of people to do a different thing. That is a bigger question.
I think that's the number one question. Thanks for bringing it up. And it's one that I'm pretty passionate about and have thought about, and I'm not necessarily correct, but at least it's something I spend a lot of time thinking about. And it's retrain them to do what? Retrain them to find some other job? Well, that's easier said than done. And most of the jobs that you mentioned are very important to the people that are doing them, but they're not necessarily noble and uplifting or what a person would choose to do with their life if they were able to choose to do things. So as these jobs, at all jobs, mental as well as physical, are taken over by robots, artificial intelligence, however you want to term these things, there will still be a role for some humans, or for some humans all the time, or for all humans some of the time, to engage in work. But it's also a tremendous opportunity to move to a society of leisure or of individual fulfillment in many different ways. The example that I would give, and I won't go on, but is the movement of sports. The whole evolution of a society that has so much leisure time that you can get a sizable portion of the population doing nothing but running around in their underwear, throwing a ball and a hoop, and people pay them gigantic amounts of money and all that sort of stuff. And that becomes a major thing that people do, is to watch these professional sports and so forth, indicates that there's one whole sector illustrating a general situation in the world today. We do a lot of people are employed to keep them off the street and to keep them in debt and to keep them obedient, not because you really need their labor.
Well, Jim, in you're a futurist, and in this envisioned world in which not everybody has to work and a lot of people are free to, you know, have a leisurely life or pursue their creativity, I picture a world in which an awful lot of people won't know what to do with themselves.
That's what the role of education. That's why I picked up what he said. We're being taught, our education teaches us to be suitable for a job.
Right.
And if anything, that emphasis is become more and more. I'm sure the dean, the vice president, can say there are tremendous pressures to produce people who can immediately do something in the workforce. But in the long run, that won't work. We have to train people how to live peaceful, meaningful lives, engaging in other people and ways that make sense to them and others.
So, Vasilis, how do you folks look at that?
So, within the university, as Tim says, our number one priority is actually to create a workforce that is useful to the state and then to the nation. So it is true that a lot of the attention in the current higher education system is not only here in Hawaii, but across the nation is in fields that they can immediately go out and find a job, a meaningful job. And most of those jobs are in the STEM fields, and the university has put a tremendous emphasis on those STEM fields. However, on the other hand, we shouldn't forgetting that here, especially in Hawaii, UH Manoa is pretty much the only liberal arts educational institution in this state. So we cannot forget one because of the other. So you'd have to try to balance the two because both have a lot of implications in our own society. So we have to create a very well-educated workforce, but also we have to create an intellectual sort of piece of our students.
And workers who are able, as jobs change, to move to others and not just
to adapt.
And I might say, as a retired professor, University of Hawaii have always been very good in that respect, and I appreciate having a dean that focuses on the technology to emphasize the humanistic as well.
We're having a panel discussion of disruptive, so-called disruptive technologies and their effect on society, particularly on business ethics. We're asking people to call us at 808-941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 on Neighbor Islands. And we have a caller on the line from Kalihi. Chris, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Yeah, on the advertisement for this program, I heard you mention Airbnb specifically as a disruptive technology. But, you know, Airbnb is not really a disruptive technology. It's really, in Oahu, it's being used illicitly to engage in illegal rentals. And, the state recently did a study where they concluded that there were 50,000 illegal rentals on Oahu with 3.8 residents per home. That's about 20% of the housing on the island of Oahu, and it's creating a housing bubble, and our legislators are just not willing to enforce it. And it's not so much that the technology is disrupting, it's just that we're able to communicate and people are disobeying the law at the expense of the next generation.
That, in my opinion, is what makes it disruptive, because you put your finger on the communication. All sorts of information about Hawaii is spread all over the world. A lot of it is not true, encouraging you to do things, to go where you're not supposed to go and do things you're not supposed to do. And it's almost impossible to prevent that under the current situation.
Right. You've got all the folks that are posting pictures from Stairway to Heaven, and you're not supposed to go up there, that kind of thing, crossing private property to get to some of these falls. Mm-hmm. So, disruptive in that regard, yes.
Yeah, I will agree with the caller. The technology itself is not disruptive. However, the business model is very disruptive, and it's disruptive because it goes around the rules, right? Or it actually touches areas that there are no rules and regulations. So in that sense, it's very difficult what the legislature can do to fix that.
A lot of this discussion tends to break down along generational lines, and that's what the next caller, Gregory from Kapolei, has on his mind. Gregory, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
All right.
I want to dovetail on what the previous caller said. You know, it's new technology. It's there because the people are using that. You know, the younger generations have embraced that, and no, we haven't caught up in terms of rules. We're trying to throw this technology into the old model, that way. It's not going to work, okay? We're going to have to embrace the new technology, It's like I'm a driver for Uber, okay? When I was when I first started driving, I'm of the older generation. I'm almost 70 years old, but I think it's great because it just eliminates a lot of things that were no good or not efficient. And I think it's way more efficient. And that's one of the reasons why you have things like Sears. You know why they're going bankrupt? Because they're embracing the old model, the new models for all new way of doing business for all these things. The older generation has to learn to embrace that. Otherwise, you know, it's the same way with NASA. Remember long ago when NASA came out with this technology and the radio industry and the record industry went crazy. But look where that is at now. Okay, so you know it's coming. You know whether we like it or not. Because the people are using it, particularly the younger people are using it more and more, and that's where the trend is going. Thank you.
We hear you. I mean, I know with my kids, they're more comfortable calling Uber and Lyft than a taxi. They're perfectly fine with banking online. They don't want to write checks. And then also, is that model then going away? And what do we embrace, right?
I think it's not a matter of embracing. It's a matter of adapting our lifestyle to what comes out. And in some cases, you know, adapting is not a bad thing. You look at I don't want to say, but traditional bookstores have pretty much gone out of business.
Liquor store.
You know, the model is very, very different. The young generation drives that model. The question is, are we going to be smart enough to adapt and drive that? And then the other question is, how are we going to make that in a safe manner? It makes sense, and we don't actually push the envelope with respect to our ethics and morals.
Right,
well,
can I
go back to the ethics question?
Because
that's exactly what this is. And my point, which I don't, you can decide whether you agree with it or not, is that our current ethics are based upon past technologies, behavior enabled by past technologies.
Right.
And therefore, we have a new technology that's enabling us to do things we couldn't even do before and therefore don't have an ethical way to deal with it. So what should we do? Should we hold on to our ethical values that derive from the past, or should we adapt and get new ethical perspectives that deal with the new technology? That's not an easy question to answer, and people have very strong feelings about it. But that, I think, is what is really disruptive. Disrupting our notions of right and wrong, good or bad, beautiful, ugly. And most of the new stuff is ugly.
On the ethics thing, because in medical research, obviously we can clone. We've cloned sheep and pets. But the question is then, you know, should we? We can do it, but should we?
I think the cloning issue goes beyond clone a certain individual or an animal, but the technology there is actually going to be used to actually clone or replicate an organ in case you actually need to have a transplant or you need to have a specialized operation. Can you do those things? The good thing and also the bad thing about medical research and cancer research is that it is very highly regulated, actually to a point that we're at the other end of the spectrum. A lot of young people or a lot of scientists says, what is even the purpose of going into that area when we're so heavily regulated by the government that sometimes impedes progress? So I would like, or as a researcher, I would like to see some of that regulation loosen up, because not only it distracts from people going these areas, but also it distracts in progress in pharmaceutical development, in disease cure. So these are areas and things that are overregulated, in my opinion.
As an educator, you want the bright young people to go into the fields of endeavor that have the greatest benefit to society. And you mentioned science, technology, engineering, math, education as being something very powerful in today's educational climate. Does the fact that you can make a lot more money faster in an unregulated environment than you can in a regulated environment like medicine or pharmaceuticals, is that creating a disincentive for the best and the brightest of the next generation coming along?
The simple answer to this is yes, but it is a bigger question, the question of what our culture teaches young people, what do they want to do with the rest of their life? Do they want to go somewhere and make an easy buck on a very short time, or do they want to truly contribute in the community and the society? So technology sometimes brings you to questions like this and dilemmas like this, and the young people obviously are enamored by new technologies and making a fast buck on a short period of time.
We want to bring listeners in on this discussion. We're asking you to call us at 941-3689 on Oahu, or at 1-877-941-3689 on Neighbor Islands. It's a discussion of disruptive technologies and the possible shifts in business ethics they may bring about. And if you've got a perspective on that, and I suspect many of us do, consider calling us at those numbers. Once again, 941-3689, 877-941-3689.
And if you're just joining us, our guests in studio are University of Hawaii Vice President for Research, Vasilis Sirmos, and Professor Emeritus of UH Research Center for Future Studies, Jim Dater. Jim, you use this line in your papers, we shape the tools and then the tools shape us. Talk about that.
Okay, well, that's one of my favorite statements. Comes from Marshall McLuhan, a Canadian philosopher of media, one of the first people, sort of the patron saint of people in the electronic communication industry, because he saw how tremendously disruptive electronic communication media would be, focusing primarily on audiovisual technologies. But in any event, the statement was, we create technologies, but then technologies create and recreate us. In fact, and so I sort of, in my own work, take that and try to tease it apart and see what that really means in various different ways. And that's where the hardware, software, orgware, as well as some other distinctions came along. Also, there's a time lag involved. It takes the immediate impact of a technology, unless it's an atomic bomb or something, which had immediate impact. Most technology takes a little time before it's a major cause of social change, a generation or two. But then what's, I think, unique at the present time, as I've said before, is the rapidity in which many, many new technologies are coming at the same time, so you never have a chance to develop an ethical comfort around you.
It's not going to be a generation or two anymore.
It's a year or two.
That's very, very much a shortened timeline,
right,
isn't it?
The question, one of the questions is, will this continue? To go to back to the STEM aspect, and thank you for pointing out the science, technology, education, and math. I've added, as many people have also, that instead of STEM, we need STEAM. With the A being arts and humanities, and the S at the end being the social sciences. And that I have, in fact, chided the University of Hawaii for emphasizing the STEM, but as he indicated earlier, they actually try to bring in the importance of the arts and humanities as well. I don't think you could say one is more important than the other.
Actually, they're both equally important, and especially on technology, you got to have to look at social science and how it impacts us. It is not in a vacuum anymore, and most of the problems and most of the solutions are on the social science aspects of the equation.
And so my question was, what will the role of science be in the future? Science as a major driving force and technological innovation as a major focus of government is for really a post-World War II phenomenon. It goes back to German research universities and the establishment of the land-grant universities in the United States. But as a major emphasis, it was something after the Second World War. And so that, in a sense, science was considered to be entirely good, and progress and change was entirely good. And people aren't so sure about that anymore. And at the same time, religion is being viewed as a rival to science, and science is just another opinion, just somebody else's opinion.
Do you find that to be a dangerous?
I find it, well, I'm more interested in the fact that it exists. and that what the consequences of that might be. So I'm not sure that science is going to be as powerful and being as well funded and be able to develop the technology in the future that it has in the past.
Well, science has created a long-established method of deciding if something is true or not, right? If at the end of the application of the scientific method you've reached a conclusion, it's the truth.
Yes.
Period.
It's a fact.
Nothing to talk about.
Yes. Right? And facts do matter.
But the climate of today is that I don't choose to believe your scientific conclusion.
I'm not going to comment on that, but what I am concerned is that, as Jim said, science does not rise in one of the highest priorities of this administration for funding. So by not funding science, you sometimes come to conclusions that it's not fact-based.
Well, what happens when we have a climate of denial of a scientific conclusion? I mean, that does need to be addressed, doesn't it?
Well, I think, again, I personally support science and the scientific method. There's no doubt about that. But I also understand where many people are concerned. I mean, there is tremendous fraud in scientific research. Not tremendous. There are examples of serious fraud in scientific and social science research. And there is always, this is one reason why scientists don't like to give public talks, is because you have to simplify the complexity of that truth in order to get people to understand it. And they then know that little bit rather than the longer bit. So I think that there have been enough instances where scientists have claimed something to be true when it is not true, or have engaged in research practices that were tremendously dehumanizing of blacks, for example, in the sorts of experiments that were done on them for
early 20th century eugenics.
So I think that there are some reasons to be suspicious, but not to the extent that it exists now.
And I want to make sure that science at this time, at least, is regulated pretty heavily. We have institutions for research boards that they actually regulate social sciences. We have the physical sciences is peer-reviewed, so it's not like it used to be even 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Well, there's got to be objective reality somewhere, right?
Exactly.
Not at all.
Oh, yeah, now
not
really,
at all.
Now you're really scaring me. There's a caller on the line, Peter from Haiku, wanted to weigh in. Peter, can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me?
You bet.
Okay, my concern about technology in recent era is what's going to be, or what's happening with the impact of what we've always considered the foundation of education, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Arithmetic, I mean, you no longer need to make physical transactions anymore. Use credit cards. I noticed my grandson has a hard time determining coins anymore, because there'll be a time when coins aren't even needed. Nobody balances checkbooks anymore. There's no need for that anymore. Writing, I mean, everybody uses a keyboard now. And so what happened to letter writing? And reading speaks for itself. The reading scores of students has gone way down. So do you see all these basics no longer being relevant in the future, or is there a place in education to maintain them?
I believe that all three things that the caller just mentioned are absolute must for our young kids. And it's not because it's technology or science, but it contributes in their critical thinking. As obsolete as arithmetic, simple arithmetic is, it provides a different aspect of critical thinking, and we shape the minds of these kids. So there's maybe a technology that actually may do these things, but if we do not teach some basic stuff, then we are actually depriving our kids from being critical thinkers, and we're going to be doing a pretty bad job, and hopefully we're not doing that.
I recall seeing a video online of a young child, I think a year, and was had picked up a magazine, didn't know what and kept pressing it because they were so used to operating with an iPad and having the pages kind of flip, and they're like pressing. My finger doesn't work. You know, I'm pressing this page and nothing happens. So it's that. That different world that it they is, operate in. So their operating system is different.
Yes, actually, they learn differently. However, that doesn't mean that the basic skills should not be taught. It's the way they learn. They learn very different from what you and I were taught back in first grade or second grade. However, that doesn't mean that the basic skills are, should not be taught or should not be there.
Well, I have a little different view on this.
Please.
And, for example, I think that Socrates, Plato maybe, was opposed to reading and writing and didn't think that education should be taught that way, as Aristotle wanted to do. Because in his day, before we knew how to read and write, knowledge was done through dance and poetry and music. And so he wanted to forbid poetry and dance, and Aristotle did. And that our memory would go bad once we learned how to read, because we would offload all these things by reading and writing stuff. And so I think there is – the point is that whatever the technology is, the software and the orgware develops around it that discommodes the previous – the people that use the other technologies. So my concern is that we need to know how to communicate. Now, what are the dominant communication modes of the of people at the present time, of children and students, for that matter, for most of the career? My career, students have not willingly read something if they could get it from television, if they could get it from an electronic game, if they could get it by from their friends and so forth. And so in my teaching, I would, not at the graduate level, but at some of the introductory level, I would read to them the parts of things that I thought were really important, which might then interest them. But what should they be taught? They should be taught how to produce television. They should be taught how radio talk shows operate and how things that are edited together on radio, for example, how that's done. And that's – our schools ignore that. Now, YouTube came along and has made it sort of possible for people to teach themselves the grammar of television and the grammar of video. But before that, I think it is something that should be taught. So our basic communication technologies need to be taught so that people have a voice and can talk back to the media, and because there are different ways of thinking. The way you think when you write is quite different from when you produce a television show, for example.
And getting back to, you know, change, we must change, I recall reading an article about, I think it was the Encyclopedia, and I think it was Microsoft or some company that said, hey, you know, we have this idea, why don't you partner with us? And they were like, no, our model works just fine. And then some years passed, and then they were like, uh-oh, we better get on this bandwagon. And by that time, the model had changed where I think it was Microsoft was saying, well, now if you want to go online, you got to pay us, you know. So it's interesting to see that.
And you don't see door-to-door sales of the Encyclopedia.
No, you don't.
Wikipedia really did a number on everyone. And, of course, initially we all resisted it. Right. How do we know it's truthful and so forth? I think for everybody it's the first place you go. It gives you something, and then you can go in elsewhere and do more research on it.
If you know how to tell, you know, sift fact from fiction, if you know how to be your own curator of information.
See, there you go, assuming there's objective information.
Hey, I'm gonna live or die on that, Jim. I mean, I've just – somebody's got to. Okay. Otherwise, you're just standing up in a rubber boat, right, all the rest of your life. There's a caller on line 3, TK from Kaneohe. TK, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Aloha, everyone.
Hi.
Aloha.
You know, I think it's just really important that everybody, like it or not, embrace technology. Now, what does that mean? It's different for every person, you know. I think for me, when it comes to technology, I look at it in a broad scope. If you're talking about bed and breakfasts, if you're talking about Uber, Lyft, what have you, I think these things are great. And I think what happens is when people start saying this is illegal, this is wrong, they're circumventing, are they really? These are homeowners that own their property. They've worked hard. They've earned money. They've bought their home. And now they're wanting to, you know, turn their bed and breakfast into something that people might enjoy. But the government comes in and says, no, but you got to regulate. We have to regulate. We need to be there. You know? Look at Lyft and Uber. In such a short span, they have become a giant in the transportation industry. We were just in Vegas just about a month and a half ago, and I was seeing the cabs. If they're not going to change their method of operating, they're not going to be there much longer. You know, so I think when we talk about technology, the impact it has on just everyday people. When was the last time any of you bought a CD, an 8-track tape, an album? You know, the technology has been created. We can download the music. Do I feel bad? No, I don't feel bad. I have family that's in the music industry. But, you know, somehow they make it like, oh, that's wrong. How is it wrong? You know? It's a technology that's been created, and so therefore people are going to use it. Now, whether you decide to use it or not, that's the question. You know, if you want to open your home up to strangers, if you want to call it that, I look at them as travelers.
Well, Judah, that's the argument that we hear about the new technologies. I'm sorry, TK, but thanks very much for your call. There's a caller on the line from Kauai, Judah from Kauai, who's part of the says he was part of the early launch of interactive tech and his work as a journalist. Judah, can you hear me?
It was the early days of covering the internet when it first emerged back in the early 90s.
Uh-huh.
And as a journalist within the industry, I saw the kind of thinking that was happening among the people who were constructing it, and there was very little interest in talking about the social effects. A lot of interest in talking about the technology and all the woods being wonderful things the engineers could develop, but there's very little interest in the social effects. So I was really thrilled when your guest today cited McLuhan about how the technology affects us as we affect the technology. That's just really good to hear somebody talking this way.
Thank you.
Well, McLuhan was clearly a prophetic thinker who saw a great deal about this coming wave, and he's certainly been proven accurate in so many ways.
Well, we've been having this great conversation, and so let's go back and say, okay, so what do the regulators do? You know, what does the city do with Lime and dockless technologies, and what does the city and state do about online platforms? I mean, what can we offer?
I think it basically can do what it's doing. That is to say, our government is designed to do things slowly. That was what the Founding Fathers originally had in mind, and when the Hawaii Constitution was built, it also has the checks and balances and everything else. And yet our economic system moves at the speed of light, and so there's this eternal mismatch between the way we try to regulate things and the way the technology wants to move. But that's all we have at the present time. I could say that I've worked with judiciaries for a long time, and often when people have a dispute about technology, they'll go to the courts to get a judicial decision rather than to the legislature to get a positive law decision, because it takes so much faster, so much time for legislation compared to judicial decisions. And so that's one model in which we move to something like a judicial branch that is able to keep up with the speed in which new decisions are desired. Because what will be a solution to Uber and Lyft and Airbnb and all the rest now may not be what they want within 5 years because of the changing situation. So we need abilities to have short-term decisions of complex technical and social issues, but that can also change quickly with the changing technologies. And our current government can't really do that, but we have to use what we have now.
Jim, you were saying when we were talking before the show that, that government, the government we have today was established on a pretty old model, which hasn't really changed since its inception.
Correct.
Does government do things like government and the judiciary need to retool?
Absolutely. And this is something that I've been – that's basically what I taught at the University of Hawaii in the Department of Political Science was new governance design. And I taught about new governance design on Mars in order to get us away from all of the realities we think about governments here on Earth. If you go somewhere, you can start all over again. Well, I've been asked to do something about Korea at the present time because they have an opportunity now to come up with something new between North and South Korea and perhaps elsewhere in the region. But most people don't think about it. Most political scientists are scientists in the sense they study what is rather than what could be. So I want people to be social inventors, invent new social institutions of which government is one. Now, we're going to have an opportunity in this state, perhaps, to have a constitutional convention. Our government constitution requires every 10 years the people say, do we want to hold a constitutional convention or not? And I understand from polls that there is some interest in it. Is that good or bad? Well, we are profoundly unprepared to think about new structures of governance. And so I'm not a big fan of rushing out to do this without some careful preparation. But to answer your question, yes, we need new forms of governance.
There's a caller on the line, Tomas from Hilo. Tomas?
Hello, aloha.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, very interesting conversation. Now, I see us, we're 120 years or so in the advance of the automobile as an innovative or a new technology. And my point of view is that it is causing havoc worldwide, from local situations to global situations. Now, we're supposed to adapt the automobile, and we do. This island, in the Hawaiian Islands, there's no limit to automobiles coming in. And what do you do? I mean, you have a continental attitude toward land use, and it comes in, it has more and more and more cars. And I don't have to tell people on Oahu the problem, but I see it happening on this island. But globally, the consequences of the automobile are incredible. You look in terms of crime. If you subtract the automobile from a criminal incident, you diminish crime by at least 50%, from a parking ticket to a violation, road rage, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the part that you spoke about, McLuhan, that you adapt to the technology or the technology will run you over, conquer you.
Thanks for that. Thanks for that, Tomas. And I think we could probably agree that there's no reversing that trend as far as the dominance of the.
Just wish that we had not invented the wheel. A wheel is profoundly unnatural.
That's where the trouble starts.
And so if we had walking cars like horses, you don't need to destroy landscapes. And so now we're beginning to develop walking robots and so forth. And so maybe the transportation of the future will go back to little trails and instead of paving everything over for the automobile. I'm with the caller on that issue.
I have a little bit of a different aspect than that. I do believe in human ingenuity, and I do believe in technology, and I believe they're going to, in the next 100 years, we're going to see magical things. The only issue I have with that, I'm not going to be here to see what magic the new technology is going to create for all of us.
Well, you can't be sure of that either.
Oh, I believe, I'm a strong believer in that because we've been around for 3,000, 4,000 years and look the wonderful things we've done.
No, I'm saying you are probably going to live 200 more years.
No, I
won't. And I'm of the mind that I like to use technology more than it uses me.
That's a good one.
We've been discussing the so-called disruptive technologies and their impact on our society. Our in-studio guests have been Jim Dator, Professor Emeritus of the Research Center for Future Studies at the University of Hawaii, and Vasilis Simas is the Vice President for Research and Innovation at the University of Hawaii. Thanks to both of you for your comments.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Interesting conversation we've been having this morning. And thank you, the listener, for joining us here on today's show.
We've got a couple of minutes left. Any final thoughts that you wish people could take away from this discussion?
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, technology is a good thing. Maybe society doesn't always use it the right way or the way it was supposed to be used. So I believe in open market. I think the government should regulate but not overregulate it. Markets do drive technology, and they drive the future of technology.
From my point of view, technology is inevitable. There's no such thing as humans without technology.
Right.
We have technology of some sort, speech, the use of chopsticks or anything. So it's not a question of anti-technology, and it's not just a question of the hardware. Again, I think the software and the orgware are important parts to think about it. How is that technology being used? And that and what are the ethical as well as environmental consequences of new technology. So I wouldn't mind slowing down technological innovation in order to think about these things a little bit better.
Well, if your call didn't make it on the air during today's discussion, you can still contact the Talkback line and leave us your comments. That number is 808-792-8217.
You also can send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you want to listen back to today's program, check out the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of the Conversation.